My name is Clancy Emmersland, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad they asked you to introduce me, Pat. I've often wondered, I wanted to hear your story. In the brief remaining minutes we have between the South Oklahoma lottery and countdown and the big dance, I've been trying to do better, but for a few years I used to talk too long, and that was kind of embarrassing, be finishing your talk and the couples were dancing by in front of me. Just when I was talking about spirituality. But I'm very glad to be here. I want to thank the committee, Bruce and his cinnamon bears, and for having me here. And I want to thank Cleve and Nell for inviting me to come and to be a part of this. I look forward to coming to Southern Oklahoma. I want to especially thank Nancy Hyde from Dallas, who was kind enough to pick me up at the airport and drive me up here. And we had a nice talk and a nice trip, and she told me her story, too. I had just... I got in the car at Denver or Dallas-Fort Worth Airport, and I said, "Well, Nancy, how are you?" And as we pulled up the lodge, I got the end of it, just...
Then I said to that son of a bitch, I said, "Well, I'm going to..."
But it was well worth the trip, because it's been an excellent conference. I listened to all the speakers, and I've listened to David and Gracie several times. I've never heard them in which they sounded better than they sounded last night. And I enjoyed hearing Bill this morning. I've known Bill since before he got sober. And he was just a son around the house some years ago. And your folks were very worried about you, too, I'll tell you that. It just kills me to think that fellow, Bill, that puke is right, yeah. I hate to say it in front of your mother. I'm not worried about your feelings. But he's the same age I am, and I look like his father. It makes me just sick. He has a painting in his closet, however, in which the guy's... Bill gave a fine talk this morning. I enjoyed listening to him. I've always enjoyed listening to Elsa, of course. She's always a pragmatist and a realist and talks about things as they are. I enjoyed them. I wanted to go to the 4 o'clock meeting, but I had advance word that they wouldn't be here for my talk tonight, so I figured to hell with them. I meditated in front of the Notre Dame game, that's right, but I did. And I know that we'll all be blessed tomorrow by Reverend Williams from Fort Worth Church of Self-Realization. Who was really one of my favorite speakers in the world. And I like Jim, and I'm very glad he's here, and I approve of him. And that's about it for tonight, folks. Can hardly wait to open my box. Hope it's a cup. Maybe it says Oklahoma and I've got a little cow poo-poo inside. But I used to drink. I want to work that in here just a little bit, a little theme. I used to drink alcohol, and I drank it for many years, as all of the alcoholic speakers and all the alcoholic people in this room have done. We've all drank, and we've all, in various degrees of demoralization, arrived here. Some to stay after they got here, some left again. And most of us have all been, we've been very fortunate in that we've had a place to go. I was thinking about, last year I had to give a talk in AA at the 50th anniversary of Alcoholics Anonymous. They had a big thing, and I talked at it on the history of AA. And I did a lot of research and homework and read a lot of things and found some old things. The thing that was impressed upon me then, as it was again when I hear old-timers speak, is to think that AA's always been here. Some of these kids here, AA's been here much longer than you've been alive. In fact, this young man who got the book tonight, what's his name? Gene? I got ties older than you. When I was your age, I was in jail. But you get the feeling that AA's been here all along, and every so often, it just as it did when Elsa was talking today. She talked about being married and having children. Now, being married and having children is nothing unusual. But there wasn't any AA at that time. Now, that makes it not very long ago when a speaker who spoke here today was married and had children, and there was no AA in the world, and there was no help for her husband, who was a drinker. Now, there was no help in the early 1930s. In all of the history of mankind, wherever they've had fermented beverages, there's always history of fermented beverages of one sort or another in written records. It seems to have been there forever. Wherever they've had records of fermented beverages, there's always some record made of some people within that society who react badly to fermented beverages. Some years ago, they thought that they were insane, or the devil had possessed them, or they were more recently weak-willed. Or as far as 100 years ago, they were putting them in the mental hospitals throughout the world. There was nothing could be done. They could put them in mental hospitals, they could put them in jails, they could send them away. Some of America, Georgia, Australia, New Zealand, a lot of places where some of the early inhabitants were alcoholic people who were sent by their wealthy families to get them out of England, to get them away. There's nothing could be done. Now, in all the history of mankind, there's never been any help for people like you and me. There have always been cures, but none of them ever worked. And we all know that story because it's in our literature about Roland, this young guy in the early 1930s, whose parents had a lot of money, and they could do anything to get him well. The Keeley cures, all the hospitals, all the religious things, everything in the world was available to them. They had the money to buy it. And they took whatever they could do. They decided to go to the whip because this kid was such a problem, and they hated to see him go like this. And they sent him to the best doctor in the world that they knew of. Dr. Jung in Europe, best doctor, best psychiatrist, most learned man of his time. He studied Roland for a while, talked to him, interviewed him, got his background, and told him the bad news. He said, "There is no answer for your problem in the world. You are what is known as an alcoholic." This is in the 1930s, after 5,000 years of alcoholism. "There is no answer in the world to your problem." He said, "Unless you are confined, you must surely look forward to a long and painful death." He said, "I wish it weren't this way." He said, "But there's nothing I can do. No amount of money can change it." Well, I imagine Roland was less than pleased with that diagnosis. Probably wanted a second opinion. "All right, and you're dumb, too. What do you think of that, Roland?" He said, "Is there nothing I can do? Nothing at all?" He said, "Well, about one in a million cases like yours has something that's called a spiritual experience, where there's some psychic or psychological relocation of the psyche, but you can't order it, you can't study for it, there's no way to get it, no one seems to be able to achieve it voluntarily. It just happens once in a while." He says, "You might get that, but the chances are very slim. So I wouldn't want to get your hopes up." But Roland came back, and this was the 1930s. and there was no answer for alcoholism in the world. And so you and I are rather fortunate. We live in the less than 1% of human history where there's any place for people like you and me to go. And the sad thing is we take it for granted. But here comes Roland back from Europe, and I guess he did something. I remember Chuck talking about that. I remember hearing other people once in a great while talk about it, being so despondent and so lost that they were able to, not consciously, but subconsciously perhaps, do something that most of us have had a great deal of difficulty with doing. Somehow there was a psychic surrender. They came here surrendered. Roland was so certain he was going to die drunk, and there was no hope, that he just surrendered to the concept. And he came back, he made some vain attempts at getting a spiritual experience, which he never got, but he went to the Oxford groups in New York, and he was so convinced he was going to die that somehow he stayed sober. He surrendered. And which brought about a couple very weird little coincidences. His surrender brought about a little weird coincidence, which enabled us, you and me, to sit in the Red River Valley rally tonight with some, at least a chance for better days tomorrow. Because I'm sure you remember the story. His parents were pleased that he was doing well, and they invited him to visit up in his little hometown and show the folks that he was all right. And they said, come up sometime. And he took a week at random to go up there. If he had gone a week before that, we wouldn't be here. If he had gone a week after that, we wouldn't be here. Now, that's what kind of a flip of the coin. He happened to get there just the week that a guy named Ebby was being sentenced for drunken driving one more time and driving his car into somebody's house. And they were going to put him away. And Roland talked to the judge and said, well, I used to be like this, and maybe Ebby will be all right. Can I take him to New York and get him out of here instead of sending him to the penitentiary? And the judge says, okay, but don't bring him back to Vermont. He's going over if he comes back. So he took this guy to New York because he happened to be there the day he was sentenced. What a narrow thread of coincidence. They get back to New York. Ebby goes to this. He's not as charmed by it, but he hangs in a little bit. And then comes the other terribly thin thread of coincidence. Ebby one day remembers there's another kid from that little stinking small town in Vermont in New York who's a drunk. His name is Bill Wilson. I think I'll go over and talk to him. So he finds Bill Wilson, goes to talk to him about what he has found. And Bill Wilson, as he said many times, just wasn't interested in hearing about it. You know, that's really good, Ebby. I want to wish you a lot of luck. But sometime after that, he had a very, very bad drinking. Another bad, bad, bad. And he woke up in Towns Hospital. And Bill Wilson became the one in the million of his generation, the one in 10 million, perhaps, who had a spiritual experience. And as he talked about it later, he talked about the wind howling through his head and the light in his room. And he came out of there somehow psychically changed. And he began to go to the Oxford movement. But he wasn't so much interested in the spiritual inner self that the Oxford movement was doing. He was more concerned in trying to help drunks. And so he would go out and try to help drunks, as he had been. And this went on for months. And Ebby would come along with him sometimes. Ebby, of course, did not stay sober. But he would go out and try to help drunks. And you'd take him out of bars and bring him home. And he would try to help him and talk to him and give him hope. And not one of those guys ever stayed sober. And after a number of months, he got a little discouraged, of course. It's kind of an embarrassing position. His wife was working. He wasn't. He couldn't get a job. That doesn't sound so bad now that I think about it. But he wasn't working. He'd bring these guys home. Some of them would steal things in the morning and leave again before they got up. Not only saving them, but they were stealing stuff out of his house. And after a number of months, he was rather discouraged. And he talked to his wife one day, and he said, "You know, what I thought was some sort of thing happening in town's hospital must have just been, maybe it's just a psychotic experience or something, but I haven't, not one person has stayed sober. I think I'm wasting my time doing this." And she, off the top of her head, probably gave the one sentence that saved your life and mine, enabled us to be here tonight. Something that would make it make sense to him. I asked her once, 3 or 4 years ago, up in Hartford, Connecticut, I said, "How in the world did you ever think of that sentence?" And she didn't think anything about it. She said, "It just seemed so obvious to me." What she said to him was, "It must work, Bill. You have never stayed sober this long." And that was the great answer. It isn't whether the person you help stay sober, it is your efforts to help them that enables me to stay sober. Which we have to remember when we work with others, even today in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because our ego gets caught up, and pretty soon you hear people, well-meaning people otherwise, say things like, "Oh, I don't want to work with newcomers. They don't stay sober when I work with them." No, but you will. And that's the name of the game. But anyway, Bill stayed sober then. He got through that, and he went out to Akron and met Dr. Bob. And they started this fellowship, and a few little people, and pretty soon it grew little by little. You'll be happy to know, when you ever read the history or hear the history, hear the people talk about those days, it gives you a little more hope for today. Because they didn't get along there and then either. And there were factions and people shaking their fists and...
"That goddamn Bill Wilson tries to run everything."
They had the resentment, but no book, so they couldn't start a new meeting. And finally in 1938, not very long ago, 1938, geez, I remember that clearly. I don't remember what happened then, but I remember 1938, so it wasn't very long ago that Bill Wilson wrote this book that published in 1939, finally after a series of vicissitudes that has become the single most pragmatically successful treatment of alcoholism in the history of mankind for over 5,000 years. And you and I are the benefits of that legacy. And I'll tell you, I am rather a cynical person. I've spent most of my adult life as a writer. I write. I manipulate people. I've spent all of my life in radio and television and advertising agencies and newspapers and writing things that'll make the mooches do what we want them to do. And I am not much impressed by writing. I appreciate writing styles, but writers, people say, "Oh, I read that book. So it's just, that's inspired, that book. It was written by a minister down in Florida. That was an inspired book." I read it and I guess it's inspired. It's just the same old razzmatazz. I don't believe that things are inspired much. In AA, since I've been sober, and after I was sober a few years, it suddenly struck me. This is maybe one of the two things I've ever heard of in my life that I believe is inspired. Inspired piece of writing. It sounds corny, but I'm saying that I want to tell you I'm a cynic because I am not a starry-eyed idealist. Everything that I read that's beautiful brings tears to my eyes. But I believe that's inspired because of one thing. And I've said this before, but I'll say it again. Bill Wilson did not know enough to write that book. He did not have enough knowledge to write that book. If you're new tonight, or if you're one of these people under 30 days, you think, "Well, Jesus, he was 3.5 years sober. Sure he knew enough." Yeah. It may seem that way when you're new. When you get to be 3.5 years sober, you realize you don't know quite as much as you'd hoped. By the time you're 5 years sober, you patronize people 3.5 years sober. "Oh, are you still here, Jimmy? Keep coming back." By the time you're 10 years sober, you hate to send people 3.5 years sober for your coffee, because they can't remember whether it's 2 sugars and 1 cream or 2 cream. "I thought I said 2. I'll get another one." Yeah. By the time you're 20 years sober, You don't want people 3.5 years sober unattended on your property. Yeah. Nothing personal, that's just the way it works. Here's a guy that wrote a book, 3.5 years sober. He had no background in medicine, no background in psychology, no background, certainly in abnormal psychology, no background in metaphysical information of the sort that is pragmatically put in here. He has no background in any of the things, and he somehow wrote things that every authority in the world for 5,000 years had not been able to compile. And it worked. And it works today. It's really amazing. The things he wrote, for example, a small example, the 12 promises. We've all heard those, and we're all so jaded with the 12 promises. Oh, yes, that's very wonderful. Because so many spiritual self-help books have all sorts of promises. The difference between those 12 promises and the promises you read in pseudo-spiritual books is that these 12 promises literally come true. And they have come true in my life again and again. I've screwed them up, but they've come back. You know. Some of them are rather delicate. I remember one time jibing with Mr. C some years ago when I was going through one of my periodic economic deprivations. That was before I fell into the job I got now. Big money down there, I'll tell you. When I was selling the TV business, I was doing tough times, but now on Skid Row, I get to go through the guy's pants pockets while they shower, and I made over 7 cents last week alone. But I was joshing with Mr. C, and I said, you know, these promises don't seem to work. You know, this economic insecurity will leave you. I've been sober a lot of years, and I got economic insecurity. And I was kind of joking, but a half minute. And he kind of smirked. And he said, no, it doesn't say economic insecurity will leave you. It says fear of economic insecurity will leave you. And if you'd worked the program, you wouldn't have this fear. Well, I went down to the club that night and bad-mouthed him. When all else fails, go to the club and bad-mouth your sponsor. That's the first law every newcomer should learn. That son of a bitch doesn't understand me at all. But all the way through this book, when I was a couple, 2-3 years sober, I was working in the medical corporation. The first job I got was in the medical corporation. And those were the first days when alcoholism was becoming kind of a socially accepted in disease for the medical profession. They just had this big study at Yale University, and they had all these, there were some funds becoming available. People were becoming dedicated in exact proportion to the number of funds that were available. Just see them light up with every dollar coming out of Congress. Those boys need help. I'm going to help them. And I was working this medical corporation, and I remember I was sober, maybe 1961, I guess I was sober 3 years. And I was writing things for the medical journals, but not on alcoholism. I would read these new ads coming out, and God, I'd just be sick of them. Where were these people 10 years ago when I was slipping and having a terrible, before I lost everything? There was a new full-page series of ads in all the journals about the first drug that would enable people to treat alcoholism clinically, to get rid of the emotional and physiological hangovers of alcohol and enable people to live meaningful lives. And it said in big letters, doctors, you can now save your patients' lives and sanity. I just, I got stuck in this goddamn AA. And that new miracle drug was called Librium. And I just was sick that it, until a couple years later, the first Librium survivors start stumbling into AA. My doctor wants me to take these. I'd already missed the all-time cure for alcoholism. Through a series of unfortunate events, I was living in an abandoned car back at the AA club at the end of 1958 and early 1959, and UCLA had come across a new drug to cure alcoholics because it would enable you to pierce through the neurotic or psychotic webs that held your soul in bondage. You could pierce through to see the reason for your illness. And they had a pilot program to cure alcoholics at UCLA, big, big hospital. And they came down to the 6300 Club, the AA Club, and asked for volunteers. And I wasn't really an alcoholic at that time. But I'd fallen on evil days, and I had no front teeth, and I was living in this car, and I smelled bad. I occasionally sponged bath in the upstairs washroom at the club, but it was only cold water, and it was wintertime. I didn't want to do it too much. So I thought, I'll volunteer. And they took my name, and they would not accept me for the program, because I guess I wasn't up to their standards. I wasn't up to their standards of alcoholism. So I didn't get taken for that, and I was just sick about that. So I missed the very famous early 1959 alcoholic cure at UCLA, and the new miracle drug they had found was LSD. Most of them died from it. Sooner or later, they all went crazy. Some of them died. One guy got back that I know, and he's been goofy ever since. He was goofy before he went, so it may not have any effect on him. But, you know, I've been screwed around a lot. I could have been cured and helped in a lot of ways. But alcoholism has, there's always been more and more interest. God, in Los Angeles, we've had some great cures. Made three pages in the Times. Remember the mid-1960s, I was working in a big advertising agency then, and I knew if I wouldn't have to go to those meetings at night, I probably would have more time for social life. And had this big thing at the hospital out at Redlands where they discovered a cure for alcoholism. And it was just great. They went into detail about it. Guys would come there, drunken, sick, desperate people. And now this was a religious hospital, but they were so eager to help alcoholics, they took one of the wards and made a bar out of it and put a bartender in there. And these poor guys would come in, you know, My family's brought me to a religious hospital. Is this going to be hideous? And they come in, and here's a bar. Be a guy back there standing behind them. Hi, pal, you want a drink? Yeah. Good booze. Hey, you Christians ain't so bad. Give me another one. I guess so they wouldn't take booze to their rooms. They had a little cord attached to the glass. They couldn't steal it, but you'd go in there for days and have a few drinks. Great. And then after about 10 days of this, you'd come in the morning, have a little drink. And as you took a drink, they'd give you electric shock through the wire. No ice next time, Fred. Then they give him a drink without the...
That's more like it, boy. For a while there, I just...
And this went on for days. These people just got like fawns in a forest fire, you know.
Terrible.
And finally the day came when they'd say, you want a drink? The guy said,
shit, no.
And another cured alcoholic hit the street.
They gave them 3 full pages in the Times how they were curing alcoholics. And it wasn't for 6 months that finally somebody did a follow-up and realized none of them, you know. Most of them didn't get... They never got beyond the first bar where there was no cords on the glass. It was just on and up. Then in the late 1960s, they also had this, or something, that general era, early 1970s, the Rand Report came out, which some of you are too young to remember that, but made every paper in the country. The Rand Report announces alcoholics can return to drinking. And they had a whole bunch of people who had done it. And, you know, there was a little line in there, except those who can't, you know, but... It really caused a stir around AA all over the world. That thing went everywhere. And again, it wasn't for several years that they finally discovered all of those cures. Some of them were dead and the rest of them were drunk and just hideous. And I know I got the Rand. I said, how in the world did you ever... How could you... You said you did follow-up on these people, and for, now this doctor in North Carolina has gone to see them, and they're all dead and drunk. What kind of follow-up did you do? He said, well, we called them every month. I could just see that. Somebody called him. How are you doing? And you're drinking. Okay. Gosh. If I could get, if they would call me from that Texas nut house, I'd never been in any trouble at all. It's just the personal visits that frighten you. Yeah. But on and on. And today there are still answers. There are still commercials on the air saying, you don't have to go to all these meetings, jump to all these things. We'll guarantee to cure you in 10 days. Yeah. And that's why I shave with Gillette. And there have been any number of keen studies made of alcoholism. I read many, many things in medical works, and now they're getting up to about where AA was in 1939. Really, the concept that it's irreversible, you cannot touch it. They don't know why it is. They've had the theories that it's a form of reverse diabetes, a hyperinsulinism, but that's been pretty well discarded. There's a study made in the late 1950s that there's a malfunctioning of the endocrine or ductless glands. I wish I'd known that. You know, be lying on the porch and you're vomiting in the snow and your wife got little children and they're sleeping and their father drunk and they're vomiting on the porch and it's morning and the neighbors can see. What the hell's wrong with you? I have a malfunctioning of my endocrine or ductless glands. Except I probably wouldn't be able to say it. And it's really ironic. What made me all this about was the time I started talking about this book. Still, there never has been a better study made, a better, more realistic, understandable description of alcoholism than the one that was read at this meeting this afternoon. There is nothing that has ever been that written that well. And it's just empirical observation. He had nothing to go on except observation. He talks about, in this book, you know, they talk about the 100 people sitting together and writing this book. And obviously that doesn't happen. As he even said later, at the time there's only 79 people. They wanted to round it off. You know, I understand that. In fact, I was talking to someone about that before the meeting. I have a son and a wife, and they are both computer wizards. And she is a supervisor of computers for SDS, and he's studying computer engineering at the university. And they sit around and discuss, and they have pencils, and they work out formulae, and everything must be absolutely correct. And I walk right through that kitchen as fast as I can. It's just that sort of whole type of thinking is foreign to me. I like to see things in kind of the big picture. Don't like that answer? How about this answer? But this book, he goes, he talks about what we have in common. And I bet 5,000 articles have been written about what alcoholics have in common. And I've come to the conclusion after 28 years of sobriety, of growing knowledge about my disease and those around me, that the one thing we all have in common is something I read in this book in 1950 and rejected. And it's just, what do we all have in common? Our size, our age, our color, our sex, our religion, how much we drank, where we drank it, whether we went to jail, whether we went to a nut house. None of these things do we have in common. If you're new at meetings, you'll see nothing that you have in common with everybody. They say, we're all alcoholics. What does that mean? That we all drank the same amount? You hear guys who say, I drank 2 bottles a day. Somebody else say, just had a few drinks every day. And all, there's no dividing line. But there is. It's in this book. Each of us, perhaps the situation's varied, and the circumstances and the specifics may have changed. But every alcoholic in the world, I believe, has been into a situation somewhere where he has been forced into an obsession that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many of us pursue it into the gates of insanity and death. And as we continue in AOA, we discover perhaps why we had that obsession. But that's what you have in common with every other alcoholic in the world. That somehow, someday, I've got to find a way to drink and get by with it. Because if you can accept that, you can begin to accept what many of us have had to accept who came here convinced we were not real alcoholics. Because my problem is not drinking. I've been in trouble for drinking, but that's not my problem. I've been in jail 30-some times for drinking, but drinking is not my problem. I've been put into an insane asylum, not for drinking. And that was a little more like it. That was for suicide because I'd stopped drinking too long and I couldn't stand it. But that's not a drinking problem. That is something entirely different. The one feeling I've had, I found a lot of people have had it, but I thought I was the only one that had it. My emotions are too intense. I feel things too intensely. I can't seem to get leveled off the way other people seem to get. I have holes in my psyche that just when I need self-confidence, there's a hole there. Just when I need some peace of mind, there's anxiety there. Just on and on. I have big emotions. I remember a few years ago listening to a guy's inventory, and he mentioned something in his inventory. And I was just stunned. He said, I didn't say it to him. I wouldn't have to think that he knew it's in me. I didn't know. But he said something about, he described an emotion, and it struck me, that is the number one emotion in my life, and I never realized it till that moment. And then rage, anger, love, none of those things. Yet so I look over my life, and most of my life has been characterized nearly always by just a low-level feeling of unease. Just kind of, this isn't it either. This isn't, this job I thought would be it, isn't it? And this house isn't it. And these friends aren't it. And I don't know where I should be, but it's not here. But I'm stuck here, so I got to go along with it. But just that low-level feeling of unease. And all is just kind of a semi-grayness in the world. Not a physical grayness, but a psychological grayness. That's one of the reasons I drank. Because at least drinking dispels the grayness for a while. Gives you some color in your life. There's an old movie, they show the NFL. I'm an old sports freak, so I noticed this. We used to run on television. But it takes the history of the National Football League, and about in the mid-60s, they have it all in black and white, all these old teams in the 40s and 30s and 50s. Then early in the 60s, as they go into the 1960s, right in the middle of a play, a Green Bay Packer starts in the line in black and white, and as he hits the line, it turns into color. And then it's all color. The rest of the movie is all color. And it really is impressive. And that's just the way I drink. That's why I drink. I just get days when I'm sick of the black and white.
Just give me a little color. I've again sent this many times. Lately, I've been a grandfather with monotonous regularity. In fact, when I get home tomorrow, one of my next to newest grandson is going to be spending the week at our house while his mother is having fun elsewhere. I'm sick with happiness. I really love that kid. I really do. I've had 50 granddaughters, it seems like, and he's the first grandson, and I love him, and I give him things. He's not quite old enough. He's only about a year. Here, John, here's some candy. Remember, I love you more than your other grandfather does. Grind away. But he came over last night after I'd gone, and I know he's there today because I've called my house 10 times today, and the phone's busy. And do you know why the phone's busy? Because he finds a phone that no one ever finds and takes it off the... Nobody ever knows how he finds his goddamn phone, but he just... Then he goes in the den and screws up the TV. Can hardly wait for him to get old enough to make his amends. But I know that at Christmas time, he and his older sister and the other girls and come and visit us at Christmas. We'll sit at Christmas time and watch The Wizard of Oz. That's something we do every Christmas, and it's on every Christmas. We have a lot of fun. And I've talked about this a lot of times, but it's really true. We get to the end of The Wizard of Oz. Now, I've watched The Wizard of Oz with my grandchildren. I remember watching with the little girl who's now in college, so it's been a lot of years. And never get to the end of that movie once. That Dorothy is just telling Frank McHugh, well, I want to go back to Kansas and be with Auntie Em. And I want to shout, don't go back to Kansas! Christ, it's all black and white back there. Stick with the color. Sure, there's some wicked witches, but you get used to that. I did. But I drank to bring color into my life, and I drank to fill holes, and I drank to fill voids, and I drank to feel solid. And I went to AA because when I got drunk, people thought I drank too much. And I went to AA a long time ago. And I liked AA. They were helpful people, but I had nothing in common with them because their problem was drinking. And my problem was continuing unease, resentments, and feelings of inadequacy and feelings of alienation and being in this crappy town and on this crappy job and in this crappy situation and on and on and on. And when I drink, that changes. Some years ago, again, I've said this before, and I hate to, but I can't change my story every time I talk just to please you. Oh, I can. Let's see now. When I came to AA in my convertible, but one of the first jobs I had, was an advertising agency. My first job off the streets, I was a year sober, I had no front teeth, and they gave me a job wrapping packages, the same kind of job I used to have when I was 14 years old. And I'd been something. I directed an opera at the University of Texas, and I was an award-winning writer, and I'd written the Elsie and Elmer ads, and I'd done a lot of big things, and I was down and out, and they gave me a job wrapping packages. My family was gone, my parents had ripped me off, my wife and children had dumped me, they'd moved out to save themselves. Everything was terrible. And I was just not doing very well, but that was the best I'd done for a long time. So I was living inside now. I had a little room over on Yucca Street. I was out of that damn abandoned car anyway. And one of our accounts was something called Kamchatka Vodka. That's why I bring him along.
It's his only activity in AA. He doesn't go to meetings. He's just Kamchatka. But one of our accounts was something called Kamchatka Vodka, and they had a big advertising campaign all over Southern California that said, vodka is pronounced Kamchatka. And it was old at that time in 1959. And they had an art department and some copywriters. They'd do these big, bold billboards, then lay them out with colors and same words always. One day I was bringing my packages out. I thought, I'm going to let these guys know that there's an award-winning writer. Looked terrible. No front teeth, old clothes, bought at the thrift shop. Somebody bought them for me. Suit that hung down on me like this. And let them know there's a guy back there that maybe they'll say, who is that guy? Let's talk to him. I said, it's none of my business. If I got an idea, art director, I remember his name, Sam Diamond. I'm going to get him someday. He's still alive. And some, a couple other guys. I said, instead of using that same copy all the time, how about something like Kamchatka Vodka goes boom, better than all vodkas anywhere. And I looked down, and they gave me the same look I've been getting all my life from people, just... This one guy says, is that supposed to be funny? Another guy, and they really got under me. They humiliated one almost, you know. He said, you know, you got a bad reputation for being a smart aleck and a smart muff. Maybe if you don't like the way we do things here, you ought to quit, go somewhere else, where they'd appreciate how dumb we are. And somebody else says, why don't you just mail the packages on time and leave the copywriting to us? We know what we're doing. That's why we get paid for it. And then Sam Diamond says, just get your packages and move it on out. And I was so, you know, when you're feeling inadequate and to have somebody pull your covers like that, and it's just, if I had a gun out, it shot him. I was just humiliated, just... Got my packages and I split. And the sponsor I had at that time, who was my sponsor my first 2 years old, he was a very strict and stern and severe man with me. But I didn't dare quit my job because I didn't know how to report it to him because he had... And that night I saw him at a meeting. Bob! Bob! And I humiliated him a lot with my immaturity. Hold it down, for Christ's sake. If you can't be a man, try to act like one. Bob. I told him this whole tragic story. Bob. And they laughed at me, Bob. I'll never be anything, Bob. They're humiliating me. They hate me, Bob. He said, now listen. And when he was upset, he waved his finger into my nose. He said, don't you ever listen to what I tell you. That's the only time I ever really missed my front teeth. And I just... But I wasn't going to give him the pleasure of gumming it, I'll tell you that. But he said, listen, they're not ridiculing you. They're not putting you down. They don't know what the hell you're talking about. Can't you understand that? Kamchatka Vodka doesn't go boom to them. To them it goes blibbit. That's why you're in this goddamn meeting and they're not. Oh, I said, I could have told you that. But you might think about that sometime. I don't know a better way to describe it. The next time you're sitting around whining, feeling sad, think, I wish, why have I been cursed with being an alcoholic? I don't think there's an alcoholic alive who could bear to be a non-alcoholic. Not now. How would you like to have your back to the wall with the hounds of fate ripping at your throat? Torment. I gotta have a drink. Oh, God. And have it go. Blah, blah, blah. Is that what you want out of life? Do you know that 93% of people who drink alcohol will never know what you and I take for granted? When your back's to the wall and the hounds are ripping at your throat. I can't. It doesn't go blah, blah, blah. It goes. Bring on your goddamn hound, Mrs. Baskerville. You with anyone, Granny? It's hard to realize that the nature of alcoholism is that it, not what it does to me at all. We always try to measure what it's doing to us to see if we're alcoholic. Immeasurable. The way it's measured is by a way that cannot be measured, and you have to get it slowly and on the natch and from people around you. It turns out you're an alcoholic because it does something special for you, not what it does to you. And most people never know it doesn't do that for everybody else. I never knew that. I thought if they didn't drink, that meant they didn't have the holes to fill I had. They didn't have the unease I had. They didn't have the anxiety. I had no idea that it had no, it provided no relief for it. That traditionally is, in a sense, what is the major difference between intense neurotics and alcoholics. Intense neurotics have most of the emotions we all have. Obsessive behavior, strong emotions, strong self-identification, strong obsessions. But they are the people for whom Librium and Valium and things like that worked, because they got to be slowed down or they might snap and become psychotic. But you and I will never become psychotic. Alcoholics becoming psychotic are almost invisible. And it turns out, and of course they say, well, what do you mean? Says alcoholism is the second greatest cause of insanity. Not from that. Alcoholic insanity is not what most of us have thought it was. It isn't an emotional condition. It's a physical condition. It's when enough of your brain has been interrupted by protracted use of alcohol, varying from body to body, that you no longer can function. Most of you have never seen a case of alcoholic insanity. You think you have, but you haven't. I see them almost every day, and I wish I never saw one. I'll tell you, a person with alcoholic insanity is not sitting in a meeting acting crazy or talking stupid or doing something dumb. People with alcoholic insanity sit on a chair or in a bed on a ward, and people come and change their diapers three times a day and feed them and put them to bed and get them up and change their diapers and feed them, and they can never get better. It's very similar to the last stages of syphilis, except for one thing. Syphilis has the decency to kill the patient. In alcoholism, you can sit like that for 40 years, healthy, except you know your name or who you are or where you've been. But alcoholics almost never become psychotic by snapping. Why? Because when it gets bad enough, long enough, they drink alcohol. And alcohol has an unusual effect to reduce conflict. And it doesn't do that for most people. That's why they cannot understand why we drink under term situations of conflict. And I can't understand why they do not drink when there is conflict. I'm not going to drink now. I got to, you know. My wife, I just thought a great example. We were in El Paso one time, and the alcoholic's lifetime friend, household finance, they were going to call us up in the morning to let us know if they're going to give us an extension on the payment or whether they're going to come and take the furniture that day. Now, we got a bunch of little kids. My wife and I were waiting for the phone to ring, and she was just sick beside herself. And I was sick and beside myself, I'll tell you. And I had some rum. I was in one of my rum phases then that came in big wicker bottles from Juarez. And I went in, had a couple hits of that, and I came back. And when the phone rang, I was the only one able to answer. Yeah. And I heard myself saying, "You keep up this shit, I'm not going to borrow from you anymore." Yeah. You show me a therapy that can do that for you in 10 minutes. The only problem is one thing. Every time it works for you, apparently, it erodes your abilities a minuscule amount in reality. So by the time that you have to do something about your drinking, sobriety is untenable. The curse of the illness is not drinking. The deadly aspect of alcoholism is that sobriety becomes untenable. Up to that point, there'd be nothing wrong with it at all. You just use it till you get tired of it and quit. You cannot handle, you get to a point where drinking is now untenable, sobriety is now untenable, and you must surely die from it. Today, we have AA everywhere. In the last 50 years, each of us have got a place to go. If you don't like AA and are willing to settle for third or fourth best, there are many other therapies out there who perhaps can help you. You can go to hospitals and detoxes and treatment centers and all sorts of places. So there's no need for anyone like you and me to ever die in America today. And that's why it's kind of sad that today, with all the help available, 95 out of 100 alcoholics in America die drunk. Why? Because there's no answer? No, we got an answer. It's because the illness stays in the mind that says, but I'm not like that. My case is different. I have these real problems in sobriety. My problem is not drinking. And that's what I think the young lady was talking about when I talked about it to Norman, because it's been the thing I've always believed all my life in AA. Drinking is a problem, but it's not the problem. And a lot of people like you and me die thinking we're not alcoholics because I have other problems than alcohol. That's what we all got. That's why we're here. Sobriety becomes untenable. That's what puts me into an obsession that someday, somehow, I will control and enjoy my drinking. I've got to believe that or I'll go crazy. Without even knowing it. I never understood the condition. I can see it in retrospect, and I see it every day in others. That's how I've learned about myself. You learn more about yourself by working with others than you will by studying yourself 24 hours a day. And it'll be a lot healthier for you, too. But it is kind of fun. I never really understood you. Which is a break. But that's why we gather here. This book talks about alcoholism. And it talks about how people like us, and we all have had it happen, and we all think we're the only ones that had it happen. Occasional brief recoveries, followed always by still worse relapse, until we get to a point of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We talk a lot in A about suicides. But it's a funny thing, relatively small number of drunks successfully commit suicide. A lot of drunks try to commit suicide, but they don't always succeed. And that's puzzled medical men for a lot of years. It never puzzled me, because I think there's a definite reason for it, is that drunken people commit suicide to make people sorry, to show them how bad they've been treated. And as they start to die, they suddenly realize, I won't be here to watch them be sorry. Maybe I'll just break open this window, get the gill of this gas out of here before. I get a call like I got once. Clancy, I want to tell you how much I appreciate your help, but nothing helps. I've taken an overdose of pills. I'm going to die tonight. I don't want anyone to bother me at 843 12th Street. Yeah. I'll tell you when most alcoholic suicides are successful? Shortly after becoming sober. That's what the stage comes. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization is now drunk you get. That's how you get after you're sober and it's all gone to hell around you. You are caught in pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. You can't even find a way to justify it to yourself, and you've got to justify it to them because they're coming after you. They want to know why. And they look at you with that hurt on their face and, oh, how could you, which is worse than hatred. And you don't know why. People who commit suicide in that stage hardly ever leave notes. Drunks leave long notes. People who really want to die don't leave notes, as a rule. They don't want to, they just can't stand it. They're in pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, some of them. And everybody's had that feeling. I'll tell you, the sad thing about it is, if you survive that and can get through that, Mother Nature, in her desire to help us, provides a scab, and pretty soon you feel better. And pretty soon you could start all over again to reach a new state of pitiful and incomprehensible. Those are called bottoms, I guess. And they're in endless supply. And I see, alcoholism is not measured by how many times you've been in jail, not by whether you've been in the insane asylum. I sponsor guys who had his last job, last year of sobriety, last year of drinking, made $250,000 and felt just as bad as I felt standing outside of the midnight mission with my front teeth kicked out. What we have to share is not how we spent our last year drinking, how we felt, and how we do about these feelings. The basic identification is a very hard one to make here, and that's why a lot of us have problems with it. But that's why you got to persist. Now, Bill Wilson had a spiritual experience, and after a while he wrote this book. And there's one other thing that I've got hope for, because it's happened to me and it will happen to you, and it's something we've got to remember. Because AA for years has been bothered by people who are waiting for their spiritual experience to happen. Now, when this book was written and published in 1939, there's only one word changed in the 12 steps from that first edition to the second edition. Only one changed. The 12th step, circa 1939, said, having had a spiritual experience as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and try to practice these principles in all our affairs. And after that was printed, some of the AAs of that era had to go to Bill and say, Bill, you know, that's not correct. You didn't get a spiritual experience as a result of these steps. You got an spiritual experience, then later wrote the steps. He said, and we're not getting a spiritual experience. It's like Dr. Jung told Roland. How do you get a spiritual experience, for God's sakes? We don't have a spiritual experience. When do we get ours? And Bill became aware, I guess, of talking with people, that his case was different, in that is bit anyway. And that isn't what made AA work at all. Not having a spiritual experience as a result of those steps. You can't get a spiritual experience no matter what you do. It just is a quirk. What makes AA so remarkable and so unusual, still we all take it for granted, but is the most remarkable thing of its kind in the world's history, is that it turns out if we take these steps one by one under some direction, we get an incremental spiritual experience. Not a boom, but you take incremental spiritual growth. And nothing else has ever been able to do that for people like us. So that's why the second edition of this book and all further editions have said, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, and so on. That's what we are here for. That's what the great out for all of we weak and fallible and emotional people follows that part of the steps where it says, no one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. You must remember that you go to meetings, sometimes you hear people who get up and apparently they're so insecure they cannot talk about their insecurity. We are, none of us are saints. We have our ups and downs. The point of AA that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to spiritual progress. We claim spiritual progress. And as long as we attempt that, you will stay sober. And your life will get better. But we are humans and we are weak and we want spiritual experiences. We want fast. Sometimes we read silly things that have never had any success anywhere, but they look good. We get involved in other things. We get caught up going the wrong direction. This is only my opinion. And I know this is not a very pleasant subject, and I probably shouldn't talk about it, but I'm asked to give you my opinion, I'm going to give it to you. I didn't hear anybody ask me to give my opinion now that I think about it. But you probably meant to. If I got to sit and listen to how the Al-Anon office has got to be straightened out, you're going to listen to me. And she's right about that, too. Now, let me tell you about that. This probably is bad for it, but I want to say it anyway. I don't want any applause for it. I don't want any hisses. I just want to tell you. In my experience, I think there are people in the world who have no knowledge of alcoholism, who have lived in alcoholic families, who have been hurt and damaged by them, and a therapy such as ACOA is undoubtedly highly helpful and gives them some insight and understanding for their parents. people in Alcoholics Anonymous who are alcoholics, who have been driven here by their own drinking, who understand alcoholism, who then get sidetracked into going back and staying back there, you are truly, in my opinion, terribly impairing your recovery. Because the whole concept of Alcoholics Anonymous is, yes, we look at those things, and we deal with them, and we write about them, and we talk about them, and then we turn them off, and we go forward. I have watched several people that I've known who have been successful and active in AA for many years who have literally returned to sullen, nasty people doing what they think is helping them therapeutically. Probably the best advice I give to AAs, and I'm not talking about other people, but in my opinion, or Al-Anons, I'm just talking about people I talk to, AAs. I'm saying this. The whole story is this. I have never seen anyone come out of an ACA meeting smiling. I have seen a lot of people come out of AA meetings smiling. And I know how to be sad and screwed. I need no help. It's happened to me all my life. I need to find a way to walk in the sunshine and say, then was then and now is now, God damn it. If they're going to start therapies for painful childhoods, I want to see adult children of Norwegian Lutherans. Yeah. Alcoholics pass out or go out to bars. Lutherans never go out and never pass out. Well, you've done it again now, haven't you? Yes, I have, and I'm going to do it again, too. I'll become a Catholic. The last thing I want to say about this Inspired book. I know it's Inspired because this book gets wiser every year. Now, that sounds stupid and like some kind of a joke. I don't mean that. The longer you stay sober and you read this, and you really read it, a good way to read it is to go to a book study where somebody... I really got into this a few years ago again because I was reading in a book study where I have to read it and make sense. You can't skim when you're reading aloud. And I thought, Jesus, that's written well. And that's so true. Stuff I never saw there in all for 28 years as I'm seeing now. Now that, I believe, is inspired. Here we are with a book that's been inspired, living in less than 1% of human history where there's been any help for people like you and me, exposed to the most successful therapy for people like you and me in the history of mankind anywhere, surrounded by people who are making it, and yet we need all the help we can get to stay here. That is the nature of the illness. That is why nearly everybody who has it dies from it. Because the biggest enemy I have is my own mind explaining that my case is different, as does yours. So that's why we don't ask you to think differently here. We don't ask you to believe differently. When all else fails, we ask you to act differently. That's why they say action is the magic word. You act yourself incrementally better. Maybe someday your emotions will catch up. They seem to. But other times they go on vacation. Well, we've been well for 2 years. I'm leaving for 2 weeks. That's why I say to you, stay active. Surround yourself with people who are doing the things, not the ones who are metaphysically explaining why they don't have to. Stay involved in taking the actions. They will keep the clouds at least dissipated enough to allow the color of sobriety to come through. I know of no better gift I've gotten out of AA. It didn't come after I was sober for quite a while. A lot of color has come into my life sober. Without that, I don't know what I'd have done. But that's the goal of AA. I find myself safe and sane and sober most of the time, unafraid most of the time, secure most of the time, a good father most of the time, a fair husband, most of the time, a good employer, most of the time, good employee, some of the time, most of the time. Now, these most of the times don't all coincide, but I keep active in AA, and it always gets better. And I think it'll always get better for you. That's why we can, again and again, no matter how it seems, how it's going, how you feel, you stand at these podiums, if you're a big deal speaker like the ones you hear this weekend, or if you stand, you sit in your chair at your little group with 10 other people, you can look around and say, my name is, and I'm an alcoholic. And through the power of Alcoholics Anonymous and the grace of a loving God that I found here, I need not drink again. Thank you.